From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll share the results from yesterday's election. We'll learn what some of the newly elected officials' jobs will look like, including the new District 3 aldermen.
They become this direct conduit for the concerns of the community, whether they be about development, whether they be about crime.
Plus, we'll get some tips from an expert on how to organize your home during spring cleaning.
As long as you're doing it regularly, 15 minutes a day, you put the food in the oven and now you're going to clean out the junk drawer. Just be consistent with it.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. In Wisconsin's spring election yesterday, Dane County Judge Susan Crawford defeated Waukesha County Judge Brad Schimmel, preserving Liberals' 4-3 majority on the state Supreme Court. Here's outgoing Liberal Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
Ladies and gentlemen, it thrills me to introduce tonight Justice-elect, the future of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Susan Crawford.
Jill Underly won re-election as Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction, and voters approved a voter ID constitutional amendment. WUWM's Mayan Silver is here to wrap up the election results. Hi, Mayan.
Hello.
Okay, so Mayan, first, tell us all about the Wisconsin Supreme Court race. What happened?
So Crawford beat Schimmel by about 9 percentage points. The AP called it at about 9:15 last night. She won 55% of the vote to 45% for Schimmel. Crawford told supporters last night that she got into this race to protect the fundamental rights and freedoms of all people in Wisconsin. She said her experiences in small-town Wisconsin shaped her into the person she is today. So here she is at her victory party, referring to the fact that her opponent was supported by billionaire Elon Musk.
But I've got to tell you, as a little girl growing up in Chippewa Falls, I never could have imagined that I'd be taking on the richest man in the world. For justice in Wisconsin. And we won!
It's also notable that Judge Schimmel called Crawford and conceded very quickly. Here's Schimmel announcing that to his supporters.
Yeah, I've called Judge Crawford and conceded.
No.
You gotta accept the results. Just don't. Yeah, right. I'm not up here making any joke. This is the numbers aren't gonna turn around.
So Crawford mentioned Elon Musk and his involvement in this race. This race was getting a lot of national and even some international attention. What can you tell us about that?
People were looking at it kind of as a referendum on MAGA. That's especially because of Musk's heavy involvement in this race, both with about $25 million in donations and turnout efforts through his PACs. He even showed up in Green Bay on Sunday in a cheesehead hat. He made a pitch there for Schimmel, and he personally handed out $1 million checks to two voters. That's really after asking people to sign a petition against activist judges for $100. President Trump endorsed Schimmel in late March as well, and former Democratic President Barack Obama got into the action and endorsed Susan Crawford. And of course, really timing is a big issue. This is all happening about 2 months into Trump's second term, along with Musk's efforts to make really drastic changes in the federal government, which includes layoffs and cutting aid and benefits.
Yeah. So the race was being heavily followed, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally. What are people interpreting from Crawford's win?
Well, Serena Sato knocked doors for Crawford and was at Crawford's victory party in Madison. She said the message is that really democracy wins and that Musk and Trump's actions are, quote, deeply unpopular.
When we talked to people over and over, they were furious with what they are doing to the federal government, furious that Musk is trying to buy their votes and that the richest person in the world thinks he controls our country.
Donald Savage also voted in Milwaukee yesterday and spoke with some of my colleagues. Opposition to Elon Musk's cost-cutting measures helped get him to the polls.
It's opposite of Robin Hood. You know, Robin Hood used to take from the rich and give to the poor, but he's doing that backwards. He's taking from the poor and giving to the rich.
Democrats have really been struggling to find their footing nationally after their November 2024 presidential election loss. In Wisconsin, Democrats had made a big investment in winning the state for Kamala Harris. It really ended up being the smallest margin of victory for Trump in any state in the country in 2024. And in a way, this could be a sign for Democrats that they're ready to fight back against Trump's second term.
All right. So one of the big stories, it seems like, from yesterday was about turnout. What do you know about what turnout looked like?
Wisconsin is generally a super high turnout state, and voters did not disappoint in this election. Early voting was more than 50% ahead of levels seen in the state's Supreme Court race 2 years ago, when majority control was also at stake. There was reporting that 7 polling sites in Milwaukee temporarily ran out of ballots before polls closed or were nearly out due to this historic turnout. Clerks all across the state really reported turnout far exceeding 2023 levels, and that's including in the GOP-leaning suburbs.
Mm. So turning to some down-ballot races, Dr. Jill Underley was reelected as Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction. She defeated education consultant Brittany Kinzer, who was backed by conservatives. What can you tell us about that race?
Underley ended up winning with about 52% of the vote. She said she was excited to get to work, fix the state's funding formula for schools.
I mean, Wisconsin loves its public schools. They're very important to the people of Wisconsin. We're still coming out of COVID. We got to make sure we fix the funding formula and we keep our teachers here in Wisconsin in front of those kids that really deserve them, and making sure that we make sure every community and every school has the opportunities so that their kids can thrive.
Christina Bry is the spokesperson for the Wisconsin Education Association Council. She said that Underley and Crawford's elections are being celebrated by educators, and she referenced what she called Elon Musk's intrusion into the state Supreme Court race.
Wisconsin votes can't be bought because we put the future of our children over millionaires.
Ben Wickler of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin said that Underley, quote, held the line against a MAGA movement dedicated to the destruction of public education. And Kinzer conceded and said she looks forward to working to ensure that 95% of students can read at proficiency and work to support local leaders who seek to do the same. Although this was a nonpartisan race officially, both statewide political parties weighed in. This race got a lot of interest and participation, perhaps thanks to the state Supreme Court race. Nearly double of the 900,000 people who voted in the 2021 race for state superintendent cast a ballot in this year's race.
So finally, what about the constitutional amendment that was on voters' ballots?
Yeah, a majority of voters approved this proposed constitutional amendment asking whether to add a voter ID requirement to the Wisconsin Constitution. Wisconsin already has a law in place since 2016 which requires voters to show photo identification at the polls or to vote absentee. This referendum on the ballot April 1st didn't ask whether to get rid of or keep that law. It would have remained in place regardless of the referendum results, but now it's harder for a court to strike down the law or for lawmakers to repeal it in the future. I just want to note that since 1848, the Wisconsin State Constitution has been amended 151 times. And ultimately, despite the losses for conservatives of the state Supreme Court and state superintendent levels, they're calling the voter ID amendment passing a victory.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for this wrap up, Mayan. Get some rest.
Thanks so much. Anytime, Joy.
Mayan Silver is a WUWM news reporter. To see all of the results from yesterday's election, visit WUWM.com. Now that we know who won in yesterday's election, let's look at what some of these elected officials' jobs will involve. With Jill Underley retaining her position as state superintendent, let's look at what that role involves. It's a variety of things, including tracking academic achievement and testing scores across the state, while managing and rating school district performance. Their department is responsible for licensing and training teachers, and also making sure state and federal dollars make it to your child's classroom. And their duties don't end there. WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel is joined by Dan Rossmiller, executive director of the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. He shares how the state superintendent impacts the education of students in the Badger State.
Let's start with the core functions of Wisconsin's state superintendent of the Department of Public Instruction. What are the main responsibilities of the state superintendent, and what are they allowed to do?
Well, Wisconsin has an elected state superintendent of public instruction, and that person is given supervisory authority over the public schools of the state. Wisconsin is unlike most other states. It does not have a state school board. So the state superintendent is essentially the person in charge of overseeing Wisconsin's K-12 public education system. Some of the duties include licensing teachers, overseeing the teacher preparation programs of the state, providing guidance and technical assistance to support public elementary and secondary education, distributing state and federal aids to local school districts, ensuring education for students with disabilities, and developing school and public library resources. More broadly, the state superintendent head is the administrative head of the Department of Public Instruction, which is the agency that carries out these functions under the direction of the state superintendent.
So in another system where the state superintendent or the person who is overseeing education for the entire state gets to focus a little bit more on the nuts and bolts of education, it sounds like Wisconsin's state superintendent does, at least to some extent, need to be politically aware or connected to work out some of these priorities and make sure that they end up in the final version of the budget. Is that fair to say? How do you see that, especially through your work with school boards?
If not partisan, there is a political role for the department. The department proposes a state education budget to the governor. That was done in, I believe, early November. And then the governor refines that, chooses what provisions to include and not include, or may choose different provisions. And then the budget that Governor Evers is going to introduce will have been shaped to some extent, sometimes more, sometimes less, by the proposed education budget the superintendent of public education and the department have put together.
The budget point is actually a great one, and I wanted to ask about that because there's then another step in the budget process, right? So how closely does the budget designed by the state superintendent usually resemble the final budget when it comes to education funding? There are a few more steps in that process, right?
Well, yeah. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Of late, it has shaped some things, but certainly not all things. Right now in Wisconsin, we have a legislature controlled by a Republican majority in both houses and a Democratic governor. So to the extent that the priorities of the legislature and the governor differ, you'll see differences in the versions of the budget that they offer.
How could Wisconsin State Superintendent protect public education in Wisconsin in the event of possible federal pressure? We're hearing a lot right now about dismantling of the federal Department of Education. Is that a role that this person needs to take on actively?
Well, we're talking about, two different levels of government. The federal government is not influenced directly by the state superintendent of public instruction. That's why we have congressmen and women and senators. It's unclear what kind of changes we're going to see. The Department of Education was created by Congress. It can only be dissolved by Congress. There can be certainly decisions made by whoever heads that department on what they're going to prioritize and what they're not going to prioritize. I don't think that if the Congress makes dramatic cuts to federal aid to state education departments, that there's going to be much that the state superintendent of public instruction can do except complain loudly about it. I don't know exactly what the amounts are, but I think Wisconsin receives somewhere between $200 and $300 million in Title I funding, which is aimed primarily at lower income students and attempts to boost their school performance. And then Wisconsin also receives a significant amount of money for the education of students with disabilities through the IDEA program, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Those are probably the two biggest sources of money that come in. And the state is mandated to provide special education services to students with disabilities by both state and federal law. And if the federal government does not fund those obligations, I think that's going to create significant problems.
Let's talk a little bit about the differences between the state superintendent and the local superintendent. Can you explain the differences between those two offices and where parents should go with concerns?
You know, local superintendents are chosen by the school board of the district that hires them, and they serve on a two-year contract, which may be extended with up to 2 one-year extensions. The state superintendent serves for a four-year term, and there's a provision for the governor to appoint a new state superintendent if the state superintendent resigns or dies in office or whatever. At the local level, it's different. I don't believe there's a requirement that the state superintendent have a teaching license or an administrator license. Most of them do have that because the whole idea of the state superintendent, going back to the original part of the Constitution, was that they wanted someone who was educated in what worked and what didn't in schools and someone that would be able to provide uniformity statewide. By contrast, the local district superintendent must have a teaching license. I don't know that there's actually a requirement that you have a district administrator or a superintendent at the local level, although almost everyone does. There are some ways that you can work around that on a short-term basis. You need to have someone with an administrator license to accept certain federal monies and to sign off on certain grants and other things. But those people are evaluated by their local school board in the first year of their employment and at least every third year after that. The state superintendent is evaluated by the voters with a four-year term. There are no term limits on the state superintendent. So we've only had 28 people serving in that office since the beginning of the state, since statehood in 1848.
The only other big difference is that the local superintendent can call a snow day. I don't think that the state superintendent does that for the whole state, right?
No, not to my knowledge, which is unusual because I remember a few years ago we had some really bitter cold, like, minus 30. And in Minnesota, the governor called off schools. And in Wisconsin, the governor does not have that ability. Neither does the state superintendent. We're a very strong local control state, for better or worse. And much of what I do representing locally elected school boards is to try to preserve a space for locally elected boards to govern and to have a say on things.
Dan Rossmiller is the executive director of the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. He spoke with WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel. After the break, we'll learn about the job of an older person. And later in the show, we'll learn about the Green Tree Apartments and the people who've been impacted by the learning center there. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Voters living in Milwaukee's District 3 elected Alex Brower to be the alderperson who represents that district on the Milwaukee Common Council. It's a special election to replace Jonathan Brostoff, who died last November. District 3 covers much of Milwaukee's east side and part of River West. But what does the Common Council do, and how does it affect residents in Milwaukee? To learn about what the newly elected alderperson will do, WUWM's Eddie Morales is joined by City Clerk Jim Ozarski.
They are the most direct level of account. They're the most at touch. You know, I say this all the time. The odds that you're going to see the President of the United States at your local grocery store is approaching none. The odds that you'll see your council member at the grocery store is pretty high. You're going to see them at the mall. You're going to see them at the movies, at church, wherever it may be. And as a result, they become this direct conduit for the concerns of the community, whether they be about development, whether they be about crime, whether they be about perhaps a new alcohol beverage establishment. They are intended to be the most direct representatives of the people that they represent.
How can residents communicate with their elected officials?
That's a great question. I think that there's a number of ways. First of all, we have a website we maintain. Each one of them has a direct email contact that's right there that goes directly to their desks. That we also have a phone directory that is right there that you can use. And you can also write them a letter. We still accept mail, so you can send that our way and we respond there. I will say that a well-structured, simple, direct email is one of the most effective ways of communicating. Council members respond very directly to that. They take that, in my experience, very seriously.
How does policymaking and passing legislation work?
It is one of those things that I struggle with. If you've ever seen the famous Schoolhouse Rock, I'm just a bill. There's this idea that people just invent legislation and bring it to a body. They don't. They get in touch with people on their local representative governments. That's where it starts, with an idea. And that idea is very often brought to council members out in public, via email, via letter, whatever it may be. And they go to them and they say, hey, about this, we have a staff here that I'm proud to work with in our Legislative Reference Bureau that researches, says, can we do this? Is this legal? What are other communities doing? They then put those things together in the form of legislation, whether it be a resolution or an ordinance, and then it's introduced to the Common Council. Common Council meets every 3 weeks. It takes in files at a council meeting and then sends it off to a committee. These committees meet during the middle 2 weeks of our cycle, make recommendations. They'll take public testimony. They'll make amendments. They'll do all kinds of things. And then at the end of it, they send it back to council with a final decision. At that point, it's very often referred over to the mayor for his review. And at that point, it usually becomes law.
Can you clarify any misconceptions about what people think the Common Council is or isn't responsible for?
Sure. We get a lot of that because we are so proximate. People get a little frustrated because they can't reach other levels of government. We have nothing to do with property deeds. Those are held over at our friends at the Register of Deeds. The Common Council has nothing to do with unemployment benefits. That's handled at the state level. Another matter that folks are always, that are concerned about, they have matters of litigation, and not with the city. We do that. But if you're litigating, say, an eviction or something of that sort, we will often point people at resources, but those are things that are managed out of the county. I think the biggest levels of confusion do come between us and our friends at Milwaukee County, what each of us does, and we always happily refer people back and forth as they deal with those issues and concerns.
Sometimes people who are on the county board later decide to run for Common Council. Could you talk about why someone would make that choice, and can that have more of an impact on the council?
Well, I love my sisters and brothers at the county board and at the county. I mean, they do important work all of their own. I think a lot of folks look over this way because they're more focused on the city of Milwaukee. I mean, that sounds like a stupid thing, but it's true. Milwaukee County is made up of 19 constituent municipalities, and there are a lot of folks that have come over here because they wanted to focus on their neighborhoods. They wanted to focus on their own backyards and all of the issues that go to that, whether it be development. We are much more hands-on in terms of the economic development of an area, whatever it may be. We are here much more hands-on in terms of licensing, in terms of being aware of what's going on. The county doesn't have much to do with that. And I think there is this desire that some have had to really reach in and involve themselves at that very, very local level, and maybe to take on a new challenge. But again, none of that is intended in any way to disparage what the county does. And I think those that have come over here, and we have had some, you're quite right, have saw it as a new opportunity, a new challenge, a new way of serving.
And is that also an opportunity that comes with different hours as far as working goes and different salary? Is that kind of an incentive as well?
It can be. There's no doubt. I mean, ever since the county board went part-time, I guess that's not a secret. It'd certainly be an inducement to do that. The hours are significant. There are more than, I think, if you ask the county board members who have made the transition to here, they will tell you that they are sometimes surprised about the level of contact they receive. The daily contact, the level of work, not so much the level of work, but the amount of daily contact that's expected, and the small range, the smaller issues, whether they be collection of trash, plowing of snow, street lights out, glass in the street, garbage not being collected, things like that, that are not what they had expected when they came over here. So yeah, there can be surprises as well as definite benefits.
Going back a little bit to policymaking, passing legislation, also residents communicating with elected officials, how can people get involved with the process before things reach the Common Council?
Well, I think having a conversation with your council member and letting your council member know that you care about a particular issue, you know, letting them know in advance you're working on something, letting people know that you have an interest in that, and that you have, you know, establish yourself via email, via personal contact, via whatever it might be, as an individual who is on the street, is active, is committed, is someone who wants to be a part of solutions, and letting them know that you can be that sort of a resource is of immense benefit. Because especially if you make those broader contacts with your friends and neighbors and build up a community from the ground up, because each one of them represents about 40,000 people. They represent, if they were separated out into the larger state, they would represent one of the largest communities in Wisconsin. And so it's impossible for them, because most of them only have a staff of one, plus, you know, in addition to themselves, it's impossible for them to keep the direct kind of contact I think they would like. And so knowing that there are individuals out there that can be a resource. Another great example that I can think of is the historic preservation community, especially in the third district has a very active preservation community, some wonderful people who are known to the council members. I know they were known to Alderman Brostoff. They were known to Alderman Kovac before. And they were people that they would turn to for advice, for counsel, as things would come in. There are very few council members I've worked with over my time here that don't make regular use of those known community resources, because they know the value that they have, the knowledge, the familiarity that they have, and they take advantage of it.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I am going to be glad to have a third district alderman, because I know that we've staffed the office since Brostoff. It's never what we want. It's never optimum. So I certainly encourage people to be supportive of him, of all the council members, but also to stay engaged. We try to be transparent. We try to be available. And if there are things that you think we're doing amiss, let us know. We're not perfect. We've never pretended to be. And this is a great level of government, because I think it is available, transparent, and responsive, and we always want to be that way.
That was Milwaukee City Clerk Jim Ozarski speaking with WUWM's Eddie Morales. Last year, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel published a series on the Green Tree Teutonia Apartments, a public housing complex and learning center on Milwaukee's far north side. The series covered the people living and working there, the institution's success stories, and how it defies stereotypes of public housing. Reporter and photographer Angela Peterson spent 15 months at the site, gathering interviews, taking photos, and getting to know the residents. She gave Lake Effect Sam Woods a tour of the site where a feeling of safety was palpable.
What does it feel like to feel safe? Of course, there's being physically safe, where your body is not in danger of physical harm. But at Green Tree Teutonia Apartments, safety comes in many forms. And for Raphael Ford, feeling safe sounds something like this. In the neighborhood. It's out there in the neighborhood. Artist name Mayhem, or Mayhem 3, Ford is a musician, rapper, and a member of the Milwaukee Hitters, a competitive drumline group that you may have seen performing at Brewers games. He spent much of his teenage years at the Greentree Tetonia Community Learning Center, catching up on schoolwork and honing his musical talents.
I learned how to do everything in there, pretty much like basic math. And I learned how to read in there because they had me read for extra time. I learned how to make music. But basically, I just learned. I grew up in there.
The Learning Center and the residents of Greentree Tetonia Apartments are the subject of a series from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Together, the two public housing complexes house around 700 residents in 328 units. Rent is calculated based on income, with the difference subsidized by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, and units are managed by the Housing Ministries of Wisconsin. Many residents stay for decades and often find work at the complex or by using employment services there. The series was led by photographer and journalist Angela Peterson, who collected stories at Greentree for 15 months. Perhaps by coincidence, or perhaps by fate, her journey to photography was nurtured in the 1970s at a community center similar to Greentree near her childhood home in Washington, D.C. And as fate would have it, her photography journey began with young love.
When I was in junior high school, I had a crush on this guy. I'll just say Dennis C. I won't say his last name.
Protect the innocent. Yeah.
And he was in the photography club. And it was actually this crush that led me to photography. And I don't always start with that story. But my girlfriends, they were like, well, join the club because Dennis is in it. I'm like, okay. So I joined the club.
Her crush didn't last, but a lifelong love for photography was born in this class. Soon, Peterson enrolled in a vocational high school focusing on photojournalism and connected with mentors at the Washington Post to kickstart her career. But even today, she remembers one of her instructors at the community center in Washington, D.C., who gave her a safe space to be herself and explore her art.
The person who led the class, and I don't know his full name, we just called him Bubba. Black man, kind of round, and kind of, you know, almost Santa Claus-ish, like, almost if you will. When he laughed, his stomach kind of jiggled and everything. But he had such a warm personality, and he was so encouraging to me when I became interested in photography.
Walking into Greentree decades later, Peterson remembered getting a similar feeling to the center that nurtured her passions as a teenager, a feeling that people cared and that she would be encouraged to be herself.
I know that Milwaukee and some communities is not very safe, but when I went through the door, I felt safe. And I think the kids there feel safe as well. They feel safe to be themselves. They feel safe to run around. They feel safe to be in a space where they can learn. They feel safe where they could be encouraged. And that's what I took away just within like 2 days of just being there. I mean, just that quick. And I was like, she's like this magnet to not only the kids, but the adults too as well.
The magnet Angela referred to is Vicki Davidson, program director at the Greentree Tetonia Learning Center. She's worked at Greentree for 26 years and even lived there for 12. Like Angela and Raphael, she remembers the support she received when she was young, both from her parents and from a friend's observation when she decided to go back to college at Alverno after having her son.
My best friend from high school said, you're going back to school? She said, you should. You're so smart. And no one had ever really said I was so smart. I really had not ever heard anyone say, I didn't think of myself as being smart. And I had to think about that. I said, well, maybe I can do this. Not that my mother and father weren't encouraging. Not that I didn't do okay in school. But for someone to say you're smart, that's huge. And I tell her right now today, you've always been a huge supporter, and it's made a difference. Those words, her words, resonate.
Today at Greentree, Miss Vicki is a never-ending source of love and support. See, many folks come to Greentree at an especially low point in their lives, when stability and safety are top priorities for adults and children alike. The Learning Center offers computers, printers, and services for filling out job applications, writing and printing resumes, and otherwise supporting Greentree residents and the surrounding community in their effort to find a stable income. For children, the Learning Center offers summer enrichment programs, scholastic support, African dance classes, games, events, field trips, and more. The result is a center where children feel safe to ask for help and to create lifelong memories.
When children remember something with joy, they remember a field trip, they remember something Mr. Martinez said or did that they can still laugh about, or they remember something I said or did that they can laugh about, that's where the joy comes in. Knowing that you created memories and that the memories mean so much that they still come back to let you know, life is good or that something may not be good. We've had some tragedies over the years, but those are the moments that we live for, I think.
But Miss Vicky will be the first to tell you that often love is rooted in accountability, in seeing the potential in someone and holding them accountable to reaching that potential. To instill this in the young people at the Learning Center, the Green Tree staff developed a responsibility paragraph, and children of all ages are expected to recite it every morning during the summer program.
It is time for me to stop blaming others for the way I act and start taking responsibility for my own actions.
I am who I am because of the choices I make.
Responsibility is the key to my success. If it is to be, it is up to me.
Miss Vicky remembers being surprised when her son, now in his 30s, still has the responsibility paragraph memorized.
Years ago, he was in a program, a Saturday program, and he's in his 30s and he still knows it by heart. He says, Ma, he says, I can't believe it. He said, but I do know. I said, you still remember that? He says, yeah, you know, when you learn something as a child, he said, it just sticks with you. And I said, well, then the key to that, of course, is if you can impart and pour into children early and keep pouring into them, it's more likely to stick with them.
Moments like this are what Miss Vicky and the staff at Green Tree lay the groundwork for. Miss Vicky will be the first to tell you that progress can be slow, and some folks slip through the cracks, unable to meet the expectations set by the Learning Center or apartment complexes. But overall, public housing communities like the Green Tree and Titonia Apartments and the Green Tree Learning Center have found a way to get countless Milwaukeeans back on their feet, one job application at a time, one reading lesson at a time, and one calming exhale at a time. And after 26 years of service, Ms. Vicky has seen dividends paid on that stability and safety in the forms of stable, successful, and safe alumni.
We've done a lot, and a lot of people have come through our doors. But you know what the most rewarding thing is to have people come back, to have parents come back and tell you, my little kids, remember them? Oh, they're all grown up now, or they're in high school now, or they're in grade school now, and they're doing good. I'm doing good. I just bought a home. I just moved into a 3-bedroom townhouse. And you know what their struggle was when they were here. And then you see from whence they've come and where they are now. That's the most rewarding for me.
And as Angela Peterson can attest, tomorrow's success stories, tomorrow's Angelas, tomorrow's Vickies, and tomorrow's Raphaels, are finding safety and stability at Green Tree as we speak.
There was one student, first name was Angel, and she walked in the first day, and she was very quiet, and she had a book. And she used this book as a shield to not associate with the other children, in my opinion. She's very, very shy. By week 3, the book had come down. She was doing cartwheels outside with the kids during recess. And it creates like this opportunity for kids to forge friendships with each other. Now, don't get me wrong, there's drama that happens too. Some kids don't like each other. That happens everywhere. But I noticed how she started to come out of her shell. And it was wonderful. And the adults, I could hear them talking about that. Look at the, she didn't bring the book today. Where's the book? You know, she's interacting. She's talking. She's, you know, she's putting her arms around someone. You know, she's broken down that shield. She's put it aside so that others could come into her space too as well. And I think that's what happens at Green Tree. They create an environment where it's supportive for everyone to be in the same space. They create a space where they want everyone to succeed.
That piece was produced by Sam Woods and includes sound from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Angela Peterson, Green Tree Teutonia Community Learning Center Program Director Vicky Davidson, artist Raphael Ford, and Green Tree Youth. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll hear from a professional organizer about how to keep your home clutter-free. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Whether you're switching to a spring wardrobe, finally cleaning out overflowing closets, or just have a mountain of unopened mail, decluttering might seem like a big task to tackle. But it doesn't have to be. To get some advice on how to approach spring cleaning, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez is joined by Tamara Starr, a professional organizer and owner of Sweet Simplicity. She shares a few tips and tricks so your home can get and stay clutter-free.
It's that time of year where some people are looking for a refresh at home, but some people might not know where to start. So I thought it'd be best to reach out to you for advice on this subject. But I want to start by asking, what exactly is a professional organizer?
Well, professional organizer is someone that's coming in and working with you most of the time side by side, helping you get through your clutter. It's sometimes a lot easier than working with your sister or your spouse who might suggest that you get rid of that dress and you feel a little offended by it. Somehow a professional organizer coming in and doing the same stuff seems a little bit easier. And we are also good at reading you and coming up with great suggestions for what to do to make decisions on letting go or how to get the house organized so that you can maintain it after we leave.
That's interesting. I'm sure that through your career, you've seen a lot and worked with a lot of different spaces. But I want to kind of dive into the process of decluttering a home.
Sure.
What's the first step someone should do?
Well, first, I want people to realize that it doesn't have to be as hard as you think it's going to be. Don't think that you have to plan the whole weekend or take off of work. It doesn't have to be done that way. As long as you're doing it regularly, 15 minutes a day, you put the food in the oven and now you're going to clean out the junk drawer. Just be consistent with it and touch one drawer at a time, one shelf at a time, whatever it is, just be consistent with them. And then once you've decluttered those little spots, then go back and then do the whole kitchen once you've done all the little things. And don't go pick the sentimental items first. Don't sit down with the photo album. Pick the really easy things to get through first. Some people will go room by room. Some people might pick a category. If you walk into your office, just pick all the Target bags, pick and save bags, your Amazon boxes. Pick those up. Those are the things I'm going to start with when I come in your house. Walk in and just start with those super easy things. And it's like, okay, I've got some of this done. And then when you get in the swing of it, or once those things have been done and the next time you come back, then you can gradually get to the harder and harder things.
Yeah, that's a really great strategy. Okay, so I kind of want to move forward to when you're starting the process of decluttering someone's home or giving advice. Is there a room you suggest people should start with?
I'm always asked where we should get started. My thing is telling my clients to pick the room, the spot that's bothering them the most. So I might come in and see that the living room has so much clutter that I think we should start here. But you might feel every single morning you start your day off frustrated that your bathroom vanity is just a mess. You can't find your things. And that's what's starting off your day. And so let's start there, and then we'll move on to these other areas. Because again, a lot of times you suddenly get motivated that, oh, that wasn't so bad, doing the bathroom vanity. Can we just do the linen closet too? Because that's part of the
routine.
And then you start figuring out what you want to do next. And we might jump to the entryway and we haven't even gotten to the living room yet, but you're finding those places that bugged you the most. When you do it on your own, you want to know that 15 minutes or an hour and a half later, you've accomplished something, it was worth it, and you're motivated to do it again tomorrow.
Yeah, no, and I know that's a good feeling when you personally, you're like, I did that.
Yes.
I finally cleaned that space. So do you ever like have like a pile of this is to donate, this is to give back?
What you might want to do is put a basket in your bedroom that once you've decluttered your whole room, you have something in there that once you put something on and realize you don't want to keep this anymore, then you're throwing it in that basket, and periodically you'll pick up that basket and know that those are things you're going to donate. Or I always say, have a spot that your friends or family know when mom stops by, she knows she can dig through that box and help herself to the Milwaukee mug or the blue shirt that she always liked on you. But people can help themselves to things that they know that you're going to get rid of. Because a lot of people struggle letting go because they feel that the donating is wasteful, that they're throwing it away. So when you connect somebody with, I call it something that pulls at your heartstrings, that if I can find somewhere in a charity or someone that's going to use it, then it's a little bit easier for you letting go. So same thing with your clothes, finding some organization that can take it and give to those in need sometimes makes it a little bit easier to let go.
Right. Well, what are some other tips that you typically or sometimes share during your presentations with people?
One thing I really like to do is the container concept. When I was working with a client, we were working in her basement. Her parents had passed away and they moved everything down from their home up north. So we're working together. She was awesome to work with. We were going really fast. She would make decisions and give me the things that she wanted to hold on to. So she was giving me things that she was keeping from mom and dad. So I would put it in a tote, and then she'd give me more, and I'd put it in a tote, and the tote was full, so I got a bigger one. She said that that was it. Don't get a larger tote anymore. I will never look at these items anymore. I can't let them go, but I'm never going to open the bin. So we stopped at that size of a tote. Well, now we started finding grandma's stuff. So she gave it to me and I walked over and I went to grab another bin to put grandma's stuff in. And she said, nope, grandma, mom, and dad all go in the same bin. So with the container concept, that decided how much you can keep. It can be a shelf, it can be a drawer, it can be a closet, it can be a room. But you're picking something that limits you on how much you can keep.
So what should people be doing daily, weekly, and monthly to stay on top of keeping their homes clean and organized?
So, you know, when your friend calls and says they're in the area and they're going to stop by, so you quickly clean off the kitchen counter or the kitchen table, flat surfaces. So one of the things I like to recommend is maybe that 15 minutes a day is just making sure that you're keeping your flat surfaces, because those are easy to become dumping grounds, to pile all up all the mail, the kids' stuff, just walking in the door and dropping packages. Let that be a great way to get started, and making sure that you maintain that, your flat surfaces, the vanity in the bathroom, the tables in the living room. But keeping control of your flat surfaces would be one thing you could do.
So for people who have implemented these tips in their life, what feedback do you hear from them? Like, what do they say to you after they've kept up, they've been consistent?
I think one of my all-time favorite comments that I get from people that I worked with in the past is that they love being able to shop in their house. Someone recently contacted me and she said that they were going to hang up pictures on the wall, and she knew that I had a bin of all the picture hangers and things like that. And just a simple thing that I had a bin for batteries, and she knew that she could go to the basement and shop. I had another lady who said the exact same thing, that she loved to be able to shop. She entertained, and we created a spot in the basement where this was all the glassware. One shelf in another cabinet was all plasticware. So she would know where to go shop in her house for whatever it is she needs. So I think that's one of my favorite things to hear back from past clients is the shopping. Because when I'm working with them, I'll say, if I ask you for a battery right now, where would you tell me to go look for it? And that's where we're going to create the organizing system. Then they can, again, maintain it after I left. So I like that they know where to go for it, and it makes it easier for them to maintain after I've left.
I love that. Thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing some great advice with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Tamara Starr, a professional organizer and owner of Sweet Simplicity. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez last spring. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from the new superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools and what she hopes to accomplish in her first year on the job. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.